My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety. Oh, I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank Harlan for asking me to share. This is a great honor for me. First time I've done something like this. It's kind of scary, but that's okay. My sobriety date is 4/29/1980. My home group is the Federal Way Men's Stag, and I always thought that was redundant. I told him, I says, men and stag, that's redundant. And he says, what's that mean? I says, I don't know. It's just redundant. You know, I love Bridget. They caught her right at the last minute. She had to come up here without any preparation. Didn't even have clothes to wear, so she had to go buy some. I had this. It's 40 years old. Still fits, almost. She said she had a nice ass. I was sitting over there, and I kept trying to look around the podium, and I couldn't. Almost, my neck is stiff this morning, but... Well, our stories are pretty much the same, except I never got pregnant at 12, but you got to miss out on some things in life. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. My dad worked for Anaconda Copper Company, and then they had the Depression, and we had to move to Sacramento, and we were very poor, and he was going door to door looking for work. He had a college education. So did my mother, as a matter of fact. So she died when I was 6, and I don't think either one of those things made me an alcoholic. They just were things that happened to people, you know. And finally he got a job up in a little town in Northern California that was I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a redneck town, pretty redneck. In fact, I sponsor a couple of African-American gentlemen, and one of them said to me, you know, I heard your background and you're redneck. He says, how come you sponsor black guys? I says, rednecks don't hate black guys. They hate everybody. Unless they're just like us, you know. Unless they're just like us. But it was a mine and a logging town and kind of rough, and I grew up kind of rough. But I had a couple of talents, and one of them was for athletics and the other was with music. I just had a talent for it. And if it had been hard to do, I wouldn't have done it because I did everything the easy way. You know, and so the small towns in those days up there in the Foothill League, there were no television at that time. This was back in the day, and local play, that was the only live sports they saw, was basketball and football. And they'd start you out in about the 7th grade running plays. It was kind of like flag football and training you, the kids they thought were going to come up, you know. My problem was that I couldn't read and write when first grade and the second grade, so they kept me back, so I was a little older than the other kids, which is an advantage in some ways. So when I got into high school and played football, I played 4 years of varsity football. I could run really fast and I could catch footballs. And we had a new coach. Before that, you know, this football was all, I don't know why I'm talking about this, it had nothing to do with alcoholics, but just the same. It's my story, you know. But I could run, and we had a new coach, and he was into this splitting out the ends and throwing passes. And we had a kid that could throw a 50-yard pass accurately. And in those days, you know, guys weren't as big as they are now. The average size of a World War II draftee was, I think, 5'7", 140 pounds. That was the average size of a man in those days. So I was a little bigger than that, and I split out the end. And one guy, a defensive guy, said, I saw you running over toward the sidelines. I thought you were going out of the game because I was out there all by myself. And everything was single wing and running. But I'm telling you this because I was very good at that and good at music. And I thought I was a big shot. You know, I was popular in high school for those reasons, so I could act like a jerk and get away with it sometimes. I think I was about, let's see, how old was I? About 11 or 12, and we got into this guy's basement, and he had homemade wine in there. And we tried it out, and most of the kids said, "Ick, it's awful, it tastes like vinegar." And it did taste badly, but that didn't stop me. And I don't remember much after that, my first blackout. Somebody said I was walking home and I threw a girl that I was at school with in the creek, but I don't think I did that. Anyway, I got in a little trouble for that. Got really, really sick. Oh, I threw up. And for a long time, wine, I couldn't stand the smell of it. how did I know I was going to wind up with a wino? Geez. But, you know, that's that aversion therapy. And it worked for a while. But after a while, I could drink beer, and then I got back to wine. And really, in my hometown, it was whiskey. I wasn't much of a beer drinker. But they'd have these American Legion Hall dances. And all these old boys, good old boys, would stand around the outside there and leaning against their pickup trucks. And they'd say, hey, boy, you want a drink? And, of course, we'd walk around there hoping for that. And yeah, and then they'd take a swig and try not to make a face because I'm a man. But boy, the feeling that comes up from that is nice. I don't know if I ever drank for psychological reasons. I probably did, but I think I drank because I liked the ease and comfort that the booze gave me. It felt good, and I liked that feeling good thing. And also, you know, I could talk to girls and dance. You know, I was Fred Astaire on the dance floor when I had a few. I could even play my horn better, I thought. You know, I thought I could. I used to play in these little bands around town, and my very first job, I was only 13 or 14, way too young for it. And this old boy told me, he says, you come play with us, all you have to do is play the melody, son, just play the melody. And he talked like that. And this band had a big bass drum with a big moon on it, you know, that lit up, and had a palm tree that curved over like this. And we were behind chicken wire. It was at Lee Bar Meadows. And every Saturday, they'd have this sound truck go through town, say, dance tonight at Lee Bar Meadows. And, you know, and I thought, oh, that sounds exciting, you know. And I like the sound of that. So when they asked me, you know, if I want to play out there, I said, yeah. And I had to crawl out of my bedroom window because my folks wouldn't let me out that late, and crawl back in the bedroom window and go play there. And I played the melody, and one old boy had a fiddle, and tears would run down his face, and he'd be sawing away. It was just a wonderful time. And the reason they had the chicken wire is people threw beer bottles at the band, you know, and everybody else. And they had, their recreation was fighting with each other outside, you know. I mean, this was that kind of a place, you know, high class. It was in a big, huge, big Quonset hut. And they'd give me a few drinks, a little whiskey now and again and that. And that was a big time, man. I was living life. And so then one day, these guys said, they want to come over to my house and play poker. My folks were down at the Legion Hall at some kind of an event. And I asked my dad, and he said, yeah, okay. And then they invited somebody else, and they invited somebody else. And pretty soon there's a hell of a big party going on there. And I don't know how to handle that. I'm drunk, you know. It's not my fault. I was drunk. So they kind of trashed the house up pretty good. And I thought we cleaned it up, but we didn't. But the girls had pulled them. We had white window blinds. They pulled them down and kissed them all over and then rolled them back up again. So we had a boarder at the time staying with it. Well, it was a friend, actually, of my stepmother's. My dad got married again, and my stepmother, I call her the stepmother from hell, and she was. And I had a big resentment against her for a long, long time, and I finally got over it. And that was hard because it was justified. Justified resentment. But anyway, so she raised so much hell that I left home. And I walked out the house, and I, where in the hell am I going? So what I did was enlisted in the Air Force. You know, there's always a card we can play, you know, if we're alcoholics. I used to get drunk at least once a week on weekends, you know, beer keg things or the American Legion dance hall. And in the dance hall, to go in, you had to be sober. So I'd take all these swigs outside then. Then collapse, you know, once I got inside. Just hold it together till I got in the dance, you know. But and that's the way it always was with me. I got into service. I'm supposed to quit at certain times, so I better take this watch, put it here. Okay, I'm gonna have to stretch. I'm not used to talking this long, I tell you the truth. So, you know, where was I?
Legion Hall, you just collapsed, you were getting back up.
Oh, yeah. So, and then I had to, then I left home because we trashed the house, and I I told it the boarder did it, or the guy that stayed with us did it. And then when he got home, he said, I didn't do it. So then I says, oh, okay. I'm leaving, because I couldn't, I can't face things. I'm impossible to face any kind of things like that. I mean, I couldn't have said, it's my fault, and I'm really sorry. The party got out of hand, and I had too much to drink. That's a spiritual life, doing stuff like that, you know. I couldn't do that. It isn't my fault. It isn't my fault. I'm leaving. I'm running. And I got in the Air Force and got into basic training. And in basic training, they had us write down if we belonged to any trade unions. Well, one time we were playing out at Lake Olympia, and these guys come in there. In those days, the unions were very strong. The Musicians Union was strong. And they said, you guys aren't in the union. We're all high school kids, for God's sake. And if you don't join the union, we're going to shut this place down, because they had a bar over on the mainland across it. This Lake Olympia thing was in the middle of a pavilion in the middle of the lake with a roof on it and that. And they swam, or they roller skated in there in the winter, and they swam in there. And some of them swam because they drank too much and fall off the causeway. But most of them just danced. But, you know, he says, so, okay, we joined the union. Hell, the union dues are as much as we made, you know, but I was in a union. I was officially a union member of Musicians Union. And so I got in the service, and they said, well, write down any unions you belong to, trade unions. And so I wrote down Musicians Union. I didn't think about it. I'm filling out the form, and I'm trying to be honest. So they tell me, go down after near the end of basic training. They said, and we were Army basic training, but the Air Force had just, Air Corps had just become the Air Force. We were still had, all our trainers were Army guys, and and our uniforms were Army uniforms at that time. And then they had just gone over. But he says, go down to the band barracks and take an audition. And I says, well, I want to be in a flight crew. I want to have a machine gun or something, you know. Well, I'd seen these movies, and I was, and by the way, in Grass Valley, this little town I came from, that's the only life I knew is the movies. And I'd see these movies where Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers would be dancing and the feathers would be flying off of a boa, and, and it just, it looked romantic and just exciting. And they had repertee, is that the word?
Repartee?
Repartee. And they had, quick wit, talking and all that, and they smoked cigarettes and they drink drinks, and it was the Stork Club or 21 Club or some fancy hotels. It was actually Hollywood Studio, but I didn't know that. And I thought the world was like that, and I wanted that. I wanted that life, that, dress up, look at me, and all that. And so I really thought maybe that was, I was searching for that. I was always looking for that kind of a bar. Never found it, but I was looking. And I'll tell you why later. I never found it. Well, I'll tell you now, I drank too much. That's why. If those places even existed, they wouldn't have let me in, So here I am in the Air Force, and I said, I don't want to do that. And they said, well, and you got two other choices. One's MPs and the other's a cook. I says, I'll go take the,
audition.
He's my helper. I'm old. I get block. Anyway, so I took the audition and I went to band school in the Air Force, and then they put me in a special service outfit, which were special bands, and I was shipped off to Panama, and we traveled all over South America as a goodwill band. And then I got shipped back to Cheyenne, Wyoming in the middle of winter. Well, by the way, I didn't talk about, I'm a pure alcoholic. I tried a little of that marijuana. In fact, the first time somebody said a bong, I said, what the hell are they talking about, Rich? He says, that's marijuana. I said, we used to call it muggles. When the musicians call it muggles. But I tried that, it's too mellow, so I can't, I'm not, I didn't, just a little. But then in Panama, I was playing one night, every night in the week, and I was doing military stuff. And then I was also playing a tea dance for an officer's club in the afternoon. That was a boomchuck stuff, You got a little cummerbund and that's for the officers. They like that. They dance in the afternoon. Ladies have, they had, It was Okinawa. Did I say I was in Okinawa? No, I was in Panama. I haven't got to Okinawa yet. Trip. Wow. Anyway, yeah. So here we are. Here we are, and I get tired, you know. So when I was a kid, they had these Benzedrine inhalers, and the kids would crush them up and either chew the cardboard in there, you know. I said, oh, you're waving at the kid. you know, or chew them up, or they'd boil them and make tea out of them, and it kind of, you know, it was the original speed is what it was. And then when they found out people were doing this, they quit manufacturing those things. But I got to Panama, and they had it in tablet form, and all you had to do is go to a drugstore and just buy it over the counter. And so I'm not a drug addict. I just had to stay awake to party. Well, yeah, well, you know. By the way, one of the guys, one of my brothers in the Federway Men's Stag, looked at me today and he says, oh, it's kind of like wrapping a pig in silk, isn't it? Because I don't dress like this, you know. Anyway, I said, yeah. Panama. Yeah. That's Panama?
Leaving.
Okay.
Leaving Panama.
So anyway, but you know, so I did that. And then when I got back to the States, they sent me to Cheyenne in the middle of winter from Panama. That's the way the military does things. I froze to death up there. And that band was one that traveled all over the Midwest, recruiting band, with the rodeo and a carnival. Seemed like the same rodeo guys and the same carnival. Is that mine? Oh, that's yours. Oh, okay. I think I turned mine off. Phones we're talking about. That's see, I forget they're recording this, and you can't see what we're talking about. That was a phone.
It's like watching the radio.
Yeah. Oh dear. So you know, we traveled all over the Midwest in these Greyhound buses, and again I felt like a big shot, you know. And I got to drink a lot, and I started getting into trouble. I always drank, but in Panama it was easier than not to get into trouble because more people drank or something. I don't know, but there they were a little different, and so they would give me company punishment. And I would keep getting busted and promoted. I got more stripes than two or three master sergeants the time I got out. I'd go down and I'd go up. And this one time, we had a band on the side, a big 15-piece dance band. And it was really good. By the way, I was a big frog in a little pond. And when I got into the service and they put me in these special bands, I had a lot to learn. I said, wow, because these guys were all professionals. I mean, you know, from the real professionals, not from small town guys like me. So I learned a lot, and I found out, you know, I got to work a little harder because I got to be better than you, you know. And so we had this big band, and I was playing baritone sax at that time, and everybody called me Serge. And I says, why? Because I'd never heard of Serge Charloff. He was a guy that played for Stan Kenton. And I had the same sound and the same style, but I didn't copy him, honestly. I'd never heard of him. And so I was always called Serge after this guy, which is an honor, really. And so we had this other band, this big five saxes and, you know, a trombone section, trumpets and the whole works. And we were playing the officers' club there because we couldn't play in town because they had a union there, and you can't undercut the union. So the CO of our outfit decided he wanted to lead the band, be the front man, because it was a really good band and getting a lot of talk, and he was egotistical SOB, like all officers, and anybody that ever could tell me what to do was a SOB all my life. If you had power over me, oh, I didn't like you. You know, guys that were nice to bosses, I thought they were ass kissers, you know. And I'll get on to this later about this attitude that I had. And so, because this was an outside job, I says, I'm not playing. I'm not going out there if he's going to be the head of the deal. You know, he's going to front the band. I'm not going there. I'm not going to play with you guys anymore. He says, okay, you be charge of quarters nights we play. That means I have to stay home and answer the telephone in the orderly room. That's charge of quarter. The Korean War had just broke out. I paid another guy to do that, and I went downtown and I got really drunk, and I wound up in the middle of the highway between Cheyenne and Laramie and didn't know where I was, had blood running all over me. I don't know what happened. You know, not my fault. I was drinking. Not my fault. And here we go. I hitchhiked one way, then I'd run over and hitchhike the other way. Finally, some guy picked me up. I says, I've had a hard time people picking me up. He says, have you looked in the mirror? You look terrible. So I got back to the base, and I was late getting back, and I'd supposed to have been on charge of quarters, and the CO was mad at me, and I was mad at him, and we'd never gotten along because he could tell me what to do. And so therefore, he was going to give me a general court-martial, leaving my post in wartime. Well, this is serious business, and I thought, oh, shit, you know. I don't think I said, God, get me out of it, because I was, oh, that's another thing I didn't bring up. Aha! The stepmother I had got into this evangel, and I'm not against religion, so don't take this wrong, but she got into this real hardcore kind of religion that everybody was going to hell but them. Even you Catholics weren't going to make it. And I know for some reason there must be a ton of recovering Catholics in AA. I've never understood why there's so many, and then I finally figured it out. They're all Irish, you know. I've never seen an Irishman that was a social drinker. But anyway, I'm sure there are a couple out there. Nothing against the Irish. But so I went to this thing, and I was in CE, and I was in this and that. But they had this attitude. And then I started seeing hypocrites around and about. And this is when I was a kid. You know, certain things went on, and I won't even say what they were. But we didn't get along very well. So I got this real attitude about religion. I just didn't want anything to do with people that went to church or mentioned the word Jesus or anything like that. And I'd just get away from it, you know, or get angry. And so when I came into AA, I had a problem. Where was I? Wyoming. I'm still in Wyoming.
Covered with blood.
Covered with blood. Yeah, so I got back and he was going to court-martial me. Thanks. That's what they're here for God's sake. Why do you think it's all men stag guys up here? So anyway, and I was really scared, you know, because I might have gone to Leavenworth for this, and the provost marshal of the base was outranked the guy that was our CO, because that's a special service outfit, and they got second lieutenants and first lieutenants and people like that in there. And he says, well, I think they're being a little harsh. He wants to give you a general court-martial. He says, what if you just sign over your stripes and we'll give you a transfer? I says, that sounds wonderful. And so they did, and they sent me to Okinawa. Oh, boy. You think that's a bad place, The Rock? Oh. That was Catch-22 and MASH all rolled into one. It was something else. Because everybody, they sent all the misfits over there at first, you know, and then the Korean War got heated up and they started sending real people over there. But we had a wonderful time. Only way you could tell an officer, he might have an officer's hat on, and he'd have a pair of athletic shorts, and if you saluted him, he'd think you lost your mind, you know, because they were mostly pilots and crazy people. And we had no duty. We didn't do anything. Played in bands outside, officers' clubs and NCO clubs and civilian clubs that were American civilian clubs for civil service workers. And they even had ratings on those, you know. If you were a GS something or another, you could be in this one, but if you were a GS up here, you'd be in this one, and you weren't allowed to be in this one. And officers were the same way. They had majors and above officers' clubs and everybody's officers' clubs and NCO club. And I was basic airman, because I didn't have any rank anymore, and I had to work hard to get 3 stripes so I could go to the NCO club. That was my motivation for getting those stripes. The only motivation is to get into, because you could drink near beer, or that 3.2 beer as an enlisted man, but you couldn't drink hard liquor until you got into the NCO club. So I made that pretty quick, because my records were screwed up a little bit, and they said the master sergeant of this outfit, he thought, well, he was a Standard Oil executive coming up. The war broke out, and they called him back, you know, like they're doing now over there. And he was really upset about this, so he didn't care what was going on. He said, well, you sound like you got screwed. We'll give you your stripes back. We'll give you a buck sergeant. Okay. Got through it again. Got away with it again. And this place was unbelievable. drink all you wanted. I had a house in the village with a, you know, girlfriend. Well, all right, girlfriend, you know. Nice. That's why you avoided venereal diseases. If you had a girlfriend. Otherwise, it was, oh, don't go too blue. All right. But he told me, don't get too blue. I didn't tell you that when I was a kid, we were really poor for a while, you know. And here's the other thing about God that I was afraid of, because I didn't have any toys. I had a tin can and a stick and another toy to play with. And I knew I was going to hell. Well, there was no help for me. I knew, you know, I couldn't help it. I really, honestly, it's a, you know, it's an addiction. And they didn't have an something anonymous for that, for little boys, you know.
Okinawa.
Okinawa. Oh, yeah. Well, well, let's get, well, anyway, Okinawa was a big party, you know, because I had a lot of money. I shouldn't tell you this, but there's a lot of stuff goes on overseas, and this special service outfit was involved in all this stuff, right up to the top. I mean, I don't know how high this went, but they had liquor, prostitution, and they had to get you involved. And so they called me in, and they says, you got the Brierley's Orange concession. I said, what? He says, you go down, you get a six-by from the motor pool, and that's all set up, and you go down to the docks when they come in, you load up with Brierley's Orange, and you give it to the village. There'll be an Okinawan guy talk to you, tell you where to go and how to do it. Okay. The reason for that was to get me involved so I couldn't rat on anybody. You know, that's the truth. And so I say it's very popular over there, they tell me, Okinawa, Brierley's Orange nowadays. But so that I got into that, so I had a lot of money. And, you know, I wasn't a dope smuggler. It was just Brierley's Orange, for God's sakes. But there was a lot of stuff went on. And I'm sure in this war now, and let's not get into that. That's political. But there's wars, things like that go on. Anyway, so I got shipped back out of there and went home. And they lost my pay record. So I had to stay in the service a little longer till I found it. And this master sergeant that was in charge of all that just gave me 3-day passes, one after the other. So I just stay. I was gone most of the time and went back. Went to work at, well, what I did was I said, I got out of the service and I said, I don't know how to do anything but run really fast away from people nowadays. And, and music, and I'm not quite that good. You know, and being me, when you know, to make a living as a musician, real living, I could have played honky-tonks for, you know, $20 a night or something once a week, but you can't live on that. So I had to get a day job, and I didn't know how to do anything. Because in school, I just messed around. One thing about my high school is if you were in sports, you didn't have to do anything else. They had to give you C's because they all, you know, you had to have your grades up to play football. And so they would even call, I understand, they'd call teachers in the office if they didn't give athletes at least a C. That's not right, but that's the way it was. And they also lied about my age, so when I got in the service, because I was 20 years old playing football for high school. Really, that's because they kept me back, remember? Back when we first started this thing, first and second grade, couldn't read and write. Anyway, I learned to read, finally. I don't write very well, but I can read. And you know,
College.
And then, you know, I went into this college, junior college, and I said, I want to make a living. And he looked at me like I'm crazy, because there you want to get an education. I didn't care about an education. I wanted to make a living. So they put me in this electronics course, and I didn't have enough math background to do that. But I see these guys over there playing grab ass and trying to start this rotary engine and messing around right across from us, and I says, and they looked like my kind of people. They were mostly ex-GIs on GI Bill going to school. And I said, what's that? And they said, that's the A&P course, aircraft and power plant at that time. Now they call it A&E course, aircraft and engine. Now they call it aircraft and power plant. They changed the name of it when we got the jets. So I went over there and asked him, and he said, yeah, you can get into this course. So I got into it. And the big focal point of that was to get an A&P license. They taught you how to pass a government test to get the license. And some of it was ridiculous because the test is all about fabric airplanes and wooden spars and that sort of thing. And once I got into working that, I never ran into any of that, but still I had the license, and I was Mr. Mechanic, you know. And went to work for a crop duster for a little while, and that was a lousy job because they'd say, don't come in today, and then they didn't pay you. And then they'd say things like, come in tomorrow, we got a lot of work, and you'd work till 3 or 4 in the morning, and they'd bring dinner in for you, but no overtime, just straight time. And then summertime, or off season, there was no work, so I went down to San Francisco and hustled around down there and got a job with Pan American. And the second day that I was supposed to go to work, I got drunk and didn't make it. So some relative died, I told him. I don't know, I have to keep track of the relatives that died so they don't die 2 or 3 times, you know. I don't know which relative it was, but somebody died in the family. That's what I told them, because I'd only wanted to work for 2 days or 3 days maybe, and I don't remember for sure, but then I didn't make a day, you know, because I got drunk. Not my fault. I got drunk. And I didn't get up in time, you know. So anyway, and I worked there, and then I got laid off. God looks after me, I'll tell you, really. He was looking after me because they posted a thing on the Pan Am bulletin board that said, anybody interested in going to work for United, they'll keep their employment office open after work. So I went down there Friday night, and they hired me, and I had to go to work Monday morning, and I kind of wanted some time off for a little party. But I was afraid to say no because I knew there was 1,000 guys behind me getting laid off, and maybe that job wouldn't be there if I asked for it. So I said, okay, and I went to work. And I worked there for, 38 years, I think it was, or so, for United. And I was what did Bridget call it? Alcoholic that still gets it together.
Functional
alcoholic, yeah. And I got drunk every day, you know, every day, and then went to work every night and get off in the morning and go over to the turf club across the street in San Francisco and get drunk and drive home without trying not to go to sleep, you know. By the way, we lost 4 guys down there that way. They were going down Bayshore Highway and went to sleep and wiped them out. And that's what happened. They sitting in the turf club with me drinking beer. And I'd be, you know, because the sun comes up right in front of you on Bayshore in the morning and drinking all day. Well, you know, it's not your fault. I'm drunk. But here I am down there and doing pretty well, really, as I was getting to work and things weren't that bad yet and I could still be a functional alcoholic. And I decided it was getting out a little out of hand, so I talked my wife in. Oh, by the way, I didn't talk about Mary. I will now. I got married right out of the service to a cheerleader, and she was 2 years behind me, and I was a big, you know, guy. And her dad had put on a big wedding, and had a big reception, and it was in a church, and we talked to the pastor before the wedding, and he told us about marriage. He gave us the talk, you know, and all that stuff. And that lasted about 6 months or a year. You know, because that was my practice wife. So then I went to work for United. I was down there a while, and then I was in a. I had a little cabin down on the right on the beach, in a place called Shelter Cove down in Pacifica, and it was a great place, except if waves would come in occasionally and cause problems. But who cares, you know? And it was a great place for a lot of reasons. In fact, one guy says, you better be a pretty good man because a lot of women come down here from San Francisco looking for a party. I said, I'm the guy. I have found heaven. But I got to know her mother because her mother drank around the nicer bars in town and she was always coughed. That's a hair thing. I learned all that. By the way, when I got to San Francisco, I knew I was kind of a diamond in the rough because I'd been raised in a small town. And so I took a course. Well, when I was in college, I took a course in English, so I knew how to pronounce things properly. Don't you know? I took a course in art, and in California Wine Institute had a course in wine appreciation. You know, so I could take the little glass and Cabernet Sauvignon. Thank you. You know. Huh? We opened the cork. Huh? You ever done that stuff? That's class stuff, baby. So I met her and we were talking and this and that, and she invited me over to her mother's house. She lived down there in Valleymar, and this is up the road a little ways from where I was. And so I went up there and I said, "What should I bring?" She said, "Bring some beer." I brought a six pack. I was a whiskey drinker. And they all laughed at me because they drank it by the case, you know. I loved her mother. Her mother drew pot in the backyard. She was like Auntie Mame, you know. I thought she was rich, so I was gonna marry her daughter. But she really wasn't. She could just speak well and dress well and look good, you know. She was a good looker. And we hit it off pretty well, and we went to Reno and got married. You know, met her in a bar, and we lived together for a little while. Even in those days, people did that sort of thing. And then we went to Reno and got married, and it lasted for 49 years. Yeah, 49 years. And she's passed away 6 years ago from lung cancer. She couldn't quit smoking. Mary liked to drink, but she drank like most people do and wouldn't get into a lot of trouble, you know. And we had good times in San Francisco. Because I knew a lot of the musicians there, and she did too. She knew a lot of the literary types. My wife had 140 IQ. Why she married me, I don't know. You know, that's a bad picker, but smart. And we had an exciting time. I fell in lust. She fell in love. And, I didn't know what love was. Love was that, you know, oh yeah, that's love, you know. That's all I knew about love. I was into me. I wasn't into anything else, but just me, you know. Better than a tin can and a stick, I'll tell you that. Well, here we are. And I'm not going to get sober yet. I still got some time.
You better hurry up.
Yeah. I'm enjoying the drunk. I don't want to get sober yet. So we were married for a long time, and at first it was exciting. We went to downtown to nightclubs and went to Purple Onion and the Hungry Eye and all those places where the new comedians were starting and saw all these guys, and just exciting, you know. And I said, this is life. I'm living life. I haven't found that particular stork club thing yet, but it's getting close. I'll be there sooner or later, you know. So we were doing that, and I could still drink a lot. There's something about alcoholics that, how come they have so much of a capacity? But they say that's a warning sign. If you can drink a lot, look out. Because we seem to have a tolerance for it at first. Here we are, having a great time, and not too much going on that's bad, but some. You know, I wrecked a car a couple of times, and, you know, just ordinary, average stuff. Maybe got in one fight or two. I don't know. I was drunk. Not my fault. Anyway, so we moved up here. I said, you know, let's go up there. And she was born in Forks, Washington, and was raised in Seattle in the Wallerford District by Lake Union. Green Lake. And so we moved to Burien, a little house over there, because I came up first, and she had to close down her work where she was working. And it was 1962, and the World's Fair was on, and rents were real high, but houses were real cheap. And I says, well, I can buy a house and pay less payments than I would pay for rent. So I bought a house, and I called her up, and she said, well, where is it? And I says, it's in Burien. And she says, isn't that close to White Center? I says, I don't know. She says, oh, I don't know. Because she's a North End girl, you know, and White Center, if you're from, well, maybe some of you don't know about White Center, but it's known as Rat City. There's my man right there. You know where the recreation club was? Yeah, I drank there. Isn't that a lovely place? That gag a buzzard off a gut wagon, that place, I'll tell you. Anyway, so pretty soon I'm getting into trouble, and they'd call me in at work, and they'd say, the office, and they'd say, your work is good, you're a good mechanic, but your attitude isn't very nice. And I'd say, what the F is wrong with your attitude? That would be my answer. We had a good union. You could talk to bosses like that. And I tell you, I didn't like bosses. They could tell me what to do. And so, you know, I, And I had a couple, three times they did that. And then I would be ill and miss work. I never took sick leave when I was sick because that's a waste of sick leave. I'd go in sick. But if you want to get drunk, why, you know. So I would miss work. And then finally Mary said, I'm not going to call in and lie for you anymore. You have to call in yourself, you know. So I wouldn't. I'm not feeling very good. I can't make it. And they'd say, what do you got, McNaughton's flu? And that would piss me off. How dare he say that to me? Because I, you know, because I did have. Telling me the truth. I don't want to hear the truth. So then, you know, it got worse and worse. How much time have I got? All right, yeah. I think I'll start getting sober now. I don't feel so good. So pretty soon she wouldn't go out partying with me anymore because there were always incidences one way or another. I don't understand this. I've had people tell me I've never been in a fight, and I said, how could you avoid it? I never understood how I could. I was always getting into something, and it's maybe because I would not keep my mouth shut. I think that's what it was. And I was drunk. It wasn't my fault. Anyway, I'll tell you this little story. I'll tell you two stories. First, I'll tell you this, that I drank up and down Ambon Boulevard, and I was barred for life, truthfully, from everywhere but Ann's Tavern, clear down in the end of Ambon. Ambon is a street that runs up through Burien into White Center. And then I started, the guy down at Ann's Tavern wouldn't open promptly at 6 in the morning. And he says, what difference does it make? What difference does it make? Jesus! But the rec center opened promptly. And they would line up there, mostly Indian guys. And they would line up there, and we'd go in there, you know. So anyway, I wouldn't come home sometimes. And Mary would get upset. And I finally told her many times. I said, I'm sorry, honey. I am sorry. And I'll never do that again. And the reason she believed that is because I believed that. I'll never do that again. And it was one last time I did that again. And I was so embarrassed and felt so ashamed of myself that I said, to hell with it. Because I'd gone to AA in about 1965, and these guys were living under bridges. It was all old guys there then. I remember, this is 65. I'm young and pretty yet. Then, you know. Anyway, and I don't know. They tell stories like they went to Boston from Seattle or something and didn't remember any of it and all that, like the stories in the book, and one of the stories where the guy traveled all over the country, and I couldn't imagine that. I wouldn't remember blackouts, but they would just be for a few hours or 24 hours, or not even that. I'd wake up, know where I was, or find out later where I'd been. But, you know, but I didn't live under a bridge, and I hadn't been to jail or penitentiaries or anything. Had I been to jail? I don't think so then. Not yet. So, I had been in jail in Nevada City for a DUI, yeah. But that wasn't my fault. I was drunk. Yeah, I spent a night in jail there. That was fun. Anyway, I was going to tell you of these stories, wasn't I? Yeah. Okay, so I couldn't go in any bars, but I took up golf. I used to race sailboats, you know. I did anything that was exciting. I was always looking for a way to have fun. And I chased fun right into the gates of hell, I'll tell you, because it wasn't much fun at the end. So here I am down there, and I just said to hell with it. As I tried AA, I'd read stuff on alcoholism. I tried to learn something about it. I tried to quit drinking. I really did try to quit drinking. And at one time, like when I went to college, I quit for 2 years, and then I drank again. That's why I only went to 2 years. Instead of 4, but I did try to quit. I just couldn't do it. I just could not do it, and I didn't understand it. And AA didn't work. Nothing worked. So to hell with it. I'm just never going home. I'm going to drink myself to death. I guess that's what I thought. I don't know. I'm pretty fuzzy by this time. So I entered the gray world. And Rich talks about the gray world. And Rich, he says, thank God for methamphetamine because it took that 15 years of utter hell that you went through into 2 years for me. So. Thank God for methamphetamine. and we have the same story, except it just took me longer, you know, because booze works a little slower, I guess, than methamphetamine. I don't know what that is, because I had to ask him once, you know, I asked him what a bong was, and he told me, and I said, and some guy standing up here right here. One of the speakers one day said, tweakers. And I said, what's a tweaker? He says, a meth addict. Oh, okay. I'm naive. I wasn't an addict. You know, little speed now and again to keep awake. But that's not the same thing, you know. I'm better than you. So here we are down there in the gray world, and it really is an awful place. And I slept in my car for a few days, and then something happened. I guess they towed my car away because I didn't know where it was. I couldn't find it, and I halfway couldn't really remember where it was. But anyway, so then I was just on a street, and I ran into this guy from Browning, Montana. It was a big Blackfoot Indian guy, and it's good to run with a guy like that when you're on the street. He was big. You ever see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? The guy in there? Well, he was like that. He was a great guy, and everybody called him Chief, so I never knew what his name was. They just called him Chief. Me and him ran together. And he knew the ins and outs of the street, and kind of saved my bacon in some ways, you know. Anyway, so we found this big box, cardboard box. I think we got it from Chubby's and Tubby's down there. Somewhere, well, it was the kind of box, you know, that appliances come in, and that was our home. And one day we're walking along past the dumpsters, and these guys were climbing out of this dumpster, and he says, we're better than them. We live in a box. You got to be better than somebody, you know. But that, you know, I'd go into that rec center and line up every morning at 6 with the Indian guys and go in there and drink white port, not Cabernet Sauvignon. I asked him for that once. He didn't know what I was talking about. I wanted to show him I had some class, you know. I said, you got any Cabernet Sauvignon? What? So he gave me a white port. You know, it's fortified, and it does the job quicker. And that's what it's about. And, you know, other stuff, you know, Mad Dog 2020 or whatever you can get a hold of. What it comes down to, and I just want to say this, I've seen women on the street, and it's a lot tougher on the women than it is on the men. They get mistreated pretty badly sometimes, and it breaks my heart. At the time, I was in the gray world, and so what, you know? So what about anybody? So what about anything? And I'd wake up every morning, and I'd say, oh, God, I'm awake. I was hoping I'd die. I really was. Went into the rec center one morning, and I'm sitting there, and I'm looking in this dirty old mirror. They had animal heads, dead ones, on the walls. And sometimes they moved, you know, and they talked to you. But they were dead. I kept saying, it's dead. I know it's dead. Anyway, yeah. And, you know, when you walk in the morning, it had this stale cigarette and stale beer smell. You ever been in a place like that? Sometimes your home smells like that for some of you, I think. No offense. Not your fault. You were drunk. Your home smelled like that. Anyway, so I looked in this mirror, and I said, God help me, how did I ever get to this? Or words to that effect in my mind. And I did say, God help me, for some reason. Because, you know, really what it was, I was scared to death of God. So if he didn't exist, I wasn't going to hell. And I was hoping that's what it was, you know. But so I felt kind of sick and funny, and so I walked outside, and I collapsed on the street. And I had a seizure because I hadn't been eating very much. You know, somebody said I wouldn't get liver cancer or liver problems if you ate regularly. That was one of the wise things they say in bars, you know, gurus of diet. So I lived on peanuts and pig's feet and pickled eggs and stuff like that, you know. The gourmet items behind the bar till I couldn't afford them anymore. But here I am, and I collapsed on the street and had a seizure. They said I had a seizure. I guess I did. And I wound up in Riverton Hospital. They took me up there. And while I was in there, I was all strapped down, going through the whips and jingles. And it was a guy, they had two of us right across from each other in these beds, and he was all strapped down. And I was looking at this guy, and he had eyes this big, and he looked scary. You know, I was thinking, I hope you don't get loose. So later on, I met him in the treatment center that I went to, and he says, you know, I saw you, and you were sitting there just staring at me, and I was hoping you wouldn't get loose. So while I was in there, this union guy came up there, and he said, they're going to fire you for not showing up to work for being unreliable, because they can't fire you for being an alcoholic, but I think you might be. Are you? He says, if you say you're an alcoholic, they will pay your sick leave, they will pay your treatment, and you can come back to work. I guess I'm an alcoholic. So I went to treatment. So God's looking after me, you know? He was looking after me. And here I am in treatment and learned a few things, you know? I learned that this was a disease, and I said, that's a good cop-out. I'll go for that one. I'm always looking for cop-outs. You know, it's a disease. Okay, I'll go along with that. It is a disease, by the way. It really is. But I thought at the time, I thought I was morally inferior, really. Had no willpower. I don't know. I just blew where the wind blew, you know, and all my life. And I didn't know how to live life. I didn't know that I had no soul. There's a big hole in there with a cold wind blowing through it. That was my soul. Because I was so self-centered that I could not see myself as I really was. I got into AA, and this old boy named Ed O walked up to me and says, I'm going to be your sponsor. So that solved that problem. I says, okay. It's like him, when I walked up to him, I says, you're going camping with me, and I'm not gay. And he said, okay. Now he talks back. He was telling me today, you should button your first button. You should take the knit off of this and comb your hair. That's the trouble when they get well, you know. When they're new, it's wonderful. If you're an old timer, you say, go sit in the corner. Okay. Don't take any money out of the basket. Okay. Whatever. Read the book. Okay. They can't even read yet, you know. All right. Anyway, I'll tell you these two little stories so you know where I came from. I took up golf when I was 65 years old. And by the way, I was born in 1928, in case you're interested. And I was 65 years old, and I quit racing sailboats because it got too cold and too hard and all that. In fact, I raced sailboats while I was drinking, and then I quit doing any of that. And the whole boat, when I went down, it had green mold all on the inside of it because it had been locked up forever, nobody around it. So I got Clorox out and wiped all the green mold off of it. Anyway, and went out racing again, and did very well, by the way. Sober, you can race as good as you can drunk. Maybe better. As we won the Juan de Fuca race, which is the short course of the Swiss Jura race. We won that 1 year. Got four trophies. First to finish, first this, first that, blah, blah, blah. You know, big shots. Yeah. I love being a big shot. Like standing up here with a suit on, you know. Wow. Got hugs from girls today. Sure beats tin cans and sticks, I'll tell you. Anyway, so here we are. Here we are. I went down by myself one day to this Foster golf course, and I said, you got single, walk on? He says, I'll put you with these three guys out there. There's three guys starting, you go out there. So I played around with them. Two of them were doctors. One of them was a retired Boeing executive. These are gentlemen, baby. You know, nice guys, really nice guys. And when we got done, they says, would you like to join our foursome? We have a perpetual tea time here every Monday at 8:45. I says, well, I'd be delighted. I know how to talk now. I'm sober. You know, I'd been sober quite a long time by the time that happened. And imagine that. Here's a guy that could not drink in any skidge bar except for the rec center and Ann's Tavern. Was kicked out of everywhere. Here's these gentlemen say, would you like to join us in our group? Isn't that something? How do you get from here to there? I don't know. And another story I want to tell is a golf story. We were out playing golf one day over here at Madrona, it was in Gig Harbor. And these guys ahead of us were drinking. They had their own bottle and they were mixing it with orange juice, I think. I don't know what they were doing, but they were getting drunker and drunker. And they said, you guys want to play through? No, you go ahead. We'll wait for you. And they're arguing and they're staggering around, and they get into the clubhouse afterwards, and we come in later and they're talking loud and using F words. And the waitress went and got the pro, and he came over and he said to the guys, he said, you're going to have to quiet down or you're going to have to leave. And this one guy says, I'm going to kick your ass. And I said to myself, now I know how that happened all the time. Yeah. Now I know. And so the pro walked away and said, okay, and called the police. And the policeman showed up, and he was going to kick his ass. And he tried to, and the policeman tasered him. And then the next thing you know, there's five cop cars there, and there's all kinds of policemen around. And then I says, oh, yeah, now I know how that stuff happens, you know. God. And two of them were kind of, one guy got up and says, that's police brutality, and he bent him over and cuffed him, and they went in the car. And the other two guys tried to sneak out. And I saw him. I said, yeah, you're smart. You know when to run. They caught him at the bottom of the hill from the golf course and DUIs, both of them. They're waiting for him down there. You know, it's not fair. They were drunk. It wasn't their fault. So, you know, that's, I saw, and that's a lesson that you learn. And I saw this, and I just, that's the way I used to be. You know, and when we were in a yacht club, we had to join a yacht club to race sailboats. And when we went back to parties after I got sober, I asked my wife, and there's, you know, I used to think everybody drank like me. And I noticed in these affairs, social affairs, they were, have a couple of drinks, and there were maybe four or five or six people that were out of line, were pretty drunk, and obviously drunk. And I said to Mary, did I act like that? And she says, yes, you did. I said, oh, God. You know. So we were married, and I mean, we had been married, and then I had to do my fourth step. And the first one was kind of a baloney thing. I got a guy that was going to go be convicted and go to prison for a long time, or a while, but he was hadn't been put in yet. And I said, I'll never see him again, so I'll have a four-step with him. And it was all lies, because I didn't know what a four-step was about. I thought it was kind of enumerating a few sins, and I didn't have very many, because I was a pretty good guy, and I didn't see why I had to do this at all anyway. You know, I was, well, not that bad. God, I got to wrap it up here pretty soon. I'm not going to be sober very long. Sorry, folks. Anyway, but I did finally do a real four-step. And what it did for me is I didn't feel really good afterwards. What I felt was very embarrassed because somehow God let me see myself. I got out of this thing I was in where I couldn't see out at all. I couldn't see me. And I was a great guy for making excuses and it's your fault, and it's your fault, but it's not my fault and all that stuff. And I thought, you're a real jerk because I'd done some things that weren't very nice, even in sobriety. I was 2 years in sobriety before I found a... higher power. And the way I found that higher power is I went over to a guy named Herb W. He was a very spiritual man, a wonderful man. He had, I don't know, he died at 92 and had 46 years of sobriety. But I went over to his house and I says, God damn it, I've been secretary, I've been a treasurer, I've been on the board of in a group, I've been in this, I've been that, I've been a coffee maker, I've done this, I've done everything in AA, and I feel shitty. I was really thinking about blowing my brains out, because I could not find a higher power. And I saw other people being happy and doing well. And I was 2 years in the program, and I wasn't doing well. And he said, Dick, you got religion and spirituality mixed up, haven't you? I says, I don't know. What's the difference? And he says, there's a big difference. He says, religion is a theology, and it's a thing of the mind, and there's nothing wrong with it. And that's how a lot of people find God, is through theology and through understanding the Bible and understanding the life of Jesus or Buddha or whoever. And spirituality is a love of a power greater than yourself, and it's inside. It's love. And he says, you go home and pray for faith. And I did, and something did happen. And then I was able to do a real four-step, find out what a jerk I was. And one of the biggest things I found out is it's my fault. And if it's my fault, I can fix it. If it's your fault, I can't do a thing about it. So I got another 3 minutes. I was going to read this thing, and then I'll leave. It says here, God in his wisdom selected this group of men and women to be purveyors of his goodness. In selecting these through whom to bring about the phenomenon, he went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went instead to the humble, to the sick, to the unfortunate. He went right to the drunkard, the so-called weaklings of the world. Well might he have said to us, unto your weak and feeble hand, I have entrusted a power beyond estimate. To you has been given that which has been denied the most learned of your fellows, not to scientists, not to statesmen, not even to wives and mothers, not even to my priests or ministers. Here I, given this gift of healing other alcoholics, which I entrust to you. It must be used unselfishly. It carries with it great responsibilities. No day can be too long. No demand on your time can be too urgent. No case be too pitiful. No task too hard, no effort too great. It must be used with tolerance, for I have restricted its application to no race, no creed, and no denomination. Personal criticism you must expect. Lack of appreciation will be common. Ridicule will be your lot. Your motives will be misjudged. You must be prepared for adversity. For what men call adversity is a ladder you must use to ascend the rungs toward spiritual perfection. And remember, in the exercise of this power, I shall not extract from you beyond your capabilities. You are not selected because of exceptional talents. And be careful always, if success attends your efforts, not to ascribe to personal superiority that to which you can lay claim only by virtue of my gift. If I had wanted learned men to accomplish this mission, power would have been entrusted to the physician and scientist. If I had wanted eloquent men, there would have been many anxious for the assignment, for talk is the easiest used of all talents with which I have entrusted mankind. If I had wanted scholarly men, the world is filled with better qualified men than you who would be available. You were selected because you have been the outcasts of the world. And your long experience as drunkards has made or should make you humbly alert to the cries of distress that come from the lonely hearts of alcoholics everywhere. Keep in mind the admission you made on the day of your profession in AA, namely that you are powerless and that it was only with your willingness to turn your will and your life into my keeping that relief came to you. It's anonymous. He writes a lot of stuff, anonymous does. Thank you very much for my sobriety. It's been a real honor.